Ja.
And why are there Bernie bros and not Bernie hoes?
So there are.
Did we talk about having edibles at my holiday party?
And that I always underestimated is that men really like breasts.
Do you think I'm a Karen?
Fallon Heise is like New Year's Eve with nuclear weapons.
What you just said was so slut-shaming. And I wanted to
see how it's slut-shaming. Welcome to the Femsplainers. I'm Danielle Crittenden. And I think I have a pretty phenomenal show for you guys this week. My guest is going to be Amy Chua. Now, she is famously the author of The Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mom, which was published exactly a decade ago. So, of course, I want to know, how did that work out for you and your kids, right? Because that's what we all want to know. Does being a tiger mom actually work? What you might not also know that Amy is the John Duff Jr. Professor of Law at Yale, and she has been the target of some pretty nasty campus politics lately, which we'll also talk about. But now I'm very excited about this. For our cocktail session, joining me is beloved cosplainer Christina Hoff Summers, who retired on the podcast, but I finally coaxed her back on to come and join me. Not least because we wanted to talk about the Dave Chappelle special, which I'd intended to watch at her house, except she gave me a couple of glasses of wine beforehand. So this is no insult to Dave Chappelle. I promptly fell asleep on her sofa, so I had to watch it the next day by myself. But anyway, she's going to join. We're going to talk about that special and some other things that are going on. And so let me bring on Christina, and then we'll bring on Amy.
Hot flashes, irritability, intimate dryness, and maybe even unsatisfying sex. My Femsplainers, does any of this sound familiar? If so, you're not alone. Bonafide is a women's health company dedicated to providing women with safe, non-hormonal, and clinically validated products that work. Bonafide offers an alternative to effectively relieve the symptoms that accompany hormonal fluctuations within their body, because every woman deserves relief without compromise. Bonafide provides safe and effective solutions to manage a range of menopausal, sexual health, and PMS-related symptoms. Bonafide offers women naturally powerful remedies to safely treat the natural symptoms that occur throughout their lives, from PMS to menopause and everything else along the way.
What I like about Bonafide products is there's one for every woman in our family. I like the Relizin, which gives me relief from hot flashes and night sweats. And for my daughters, there's Serenol, which gives them relief from emotional PMS symptoms, which, you know, I think we can all appreciate. They have many other products as well.
As a woman, what I like most is that Bonafide products provide women real relief without compromise. So don't waste another minute feeling less than your best. Give Bonafide a try today. No prescription is required. Go to hellobonafide.com. That's hello, B-O-N-A-F-I-D-E. Go to hellobonafide.com and use code FEMSPLAIN to save 20%. That's hellobonafide.com and use code FEMSPLAIN to save 20%.
Hi, Christina.
Hi, Danielle. It's great to be back. But can I do some fact checking here?
Yeah.
You came to my house. I gave you wine. You happily poured yourself several glasses.
No, you insisted. I really had no choice. I really had no choice. I felt I was afraid. I worried if I didn't have the wine, you know,
I would judge you.
You would judge me, but I also felt pressured.
Well, I remember it differently. We'll have to go back and hopefully I had the tape recorder on. We can go back and see.
Well, then to make me even more uncomfortable, you pressure me into having wine and then force me to sit and watch this offensive, you know, comedy special by Dave Chappelle, which was so upsetting and you were so insulting.
I honestly wondered what you were going to think. You were cracking up, but then you fell asleep. And then just to further check the record, we were watching it because we're waiting for Succession to come on.
Right.
Finally, I wake you up. It's on. I think, okay, now she'll be, you fell asleep.
Wine and television just don't mix for me. If I'm going to watch TV,
I just have a very comfortable TV room because you are the third person who's gone to sleep down there.
Maybe you are. God knows what you're doing to people in your basement, getting them drunk. You probably put a pill in my wine, and then God knows what happened.
Well, my nephew fell asleep, and I couldn't wake him up. He stayed there the whole night.
Oh, because you had drugged him.
I guess. Don't come to my basement.
Well, okay. So I did watch the Dave Chappelle special. And of course, you and I are both interested in the remarks he had to say about basically supporting women's rights. And, he talked about how he is not anti-trans, but he wants to, you know, humor should be, comedy is comedy, and people shouldn't take offense no matter what you say. And I felt that was actually disingenuous because I thought I was excited that he talked about the fact that biology exists. You know, he made the line about every person here has come through a woman's legs to get here at some point, or out of their stomach, is it maybe? But I just felt his whole shtick was proving how pro-trans he was. And it was less about
A little defensive.
Yeah, it was very defensive.
And in fact, anyone that doesn't know his other specials, I recommend watching them because he's better than that. There were some great jokes stipulated. Mm-hmm. It was still worth it I love his facial expressions and his quirky take on things, but he was a little defensive. And I suppose it's because he's been hurt. He feels, and it's same with J.K. Rowling. You would think that someone at that level was beyond reach of criticism, but they're not. So he's a little.
What happened to her, and he referenced it, was true. I mean, cancellation to the degree it can happen to someone. Of course, she's got her wealth and you can say boo-hoo, but they tore her name off libraries that she banned her books from curriculums. And I thought the important thing about Chappelle is not even so much what he had to say, but that Netflix stood behind him, that did not capitulate to the pressure to
except that I do wonder if a lesser known comedian came along.
And pitched that. Would they air it?
No. Yeah, I think we're going to get a lot more Hannah Gatsby wannabes. And, she may not come on again. But I don't think it's clear what wins in this battle. What I found amusing was that the media was carried away with this demonstration that there was going to be a walkout of thousands of employees at Netflix. It turned out it was a few dozen, maybe in half media. And then there was this YouTuber.
Oh, you sent me this clip. We have to play Walsy,
who did actually something. It's a trick. It's a shtick that he does. It's very funny. He goes to demonstrations. He went to this demonstration. And just sort of as not to oppose it or anything, but just to be a kind of bizarre element in the mix. So he came with his friend and they had these innocuous signs like, I like Dave. Jokes are funny.
Yeah.
And walked around marching, not contentious, not provocative. He's just sort of a big genial character. And the crowd, a few members of the crowd just became violent. And there was one man who works for Netflix who grabbed his sign and was sort of manhandling him and then immediately accused him of having a weapon because he was left with a stick.
So it was its own comedy.
And then he had to drop it. And then these two women come up to him I don't know if it was an exorcism. They had a tambourine and they were saying, "Repent, you motherfucker," screaming it at the top of their lungs. And then he was just saying, "I like Dave, repent." You should just play a bit of it.
I'm just here to say that jokes are funny, people. Dave Chappelle is a funny guy. I love Dave. I don't know why all the violence. I don't know why all the hate. I just love Dave Chappelle. Dave Chappelle!
It's funnier than Dave's special.
Well, I guess we're in this weird thing where, you know, I take Chappelle's point that it's comedy. And why are we having op-eds? Why are we having these serious discussions
exactly
about comedy?
Why is it such a big deal?
Except that I think the real genius of this type of comedy is Monty Python, where they are able to send up everything.
Right.
Remember
Mel Brooks,
or like the Romans, you know, they don't go after the subject itself, but you know, what have the Romans ever done for us? The aqueduct.
Right.
I mean, anybody who knows Monty Python knows these sketches by heart.
Right.
And they come back to me over years where I suddenly look at something and I realize, oh my God, this is just exactly what Monty Python was making fun of, even though they did it in medieval or ancient Roman costume, you know? And I think, so if you're going to come out and make these jokes, you can't be surprised by the reaction to them. And then I did think, instead of leaning into it, he did spend a lot of his time sort of morally preening about why my best friend is a trans comedian.
Yeah,
that
and he did play the identity politics card himself.
Right.
So I can get, we're the most depressed, you know, you get off easy. And
right.
But, you know, there were just so many funny lines. Like when he was saying about the women's march and how the women coordinated their costumes for the Emmys and the Academy Awards. And he said, I don't think Martin Luther King said, okay, at the next march, we're going to wear matching outfits. You know?
Well, also, I think his most effective joke on this whole controversy was that he was, who is this guy, Baby, this rapper or something?
Baby.
Yes, who made homophobic remark, I don't know, but on stage, and then everybody was calling for his head, and he pointed out this guy had shot
somebody in Walmart
several years ago, and his career did not suffer.
So, but you make a joke about the tea people. Yeah.
So anyway, so it's
and you know, there are a lot of trans people that can take a joke.
Right.
I'm not certain at all that this little group of hardliners that they represent the majority. So I'm glad there was pushback against that, but we'll see where this goes.
Well, meanwhile, this story about this so-called trans bathroom attack. This is now in defense of the trans. This is a story, and we just discovered this yesterday.
This week. Because of Kathy Young.
So earlier this month, our listeners should probably well familiar with this. There was a Loudoun County, Virginia story, the sexual assault that
you
had taken.
Loudoun.
Is it Loudoun?
Loudoun?
Loudoun County, Virginia.
Yes.
Story of a sexual assault that took place. And this is how it's been reported until, like 48 hours ago, that a high school girl had gone into a girl's bathroom and there'd been a man in a skirt or boy in a skirt. Who was self-identified as a woman and raped her.
Binary.
Yeah, whatever, but was using the bathroom.
The worst case scenario in the mind of everyone that protests
totally
the bathroom
and
policy.
My husband David always warns me that whenever a story just
fits an agenda perfectly,
fits
like
so
a glove.
Perfectly, or that you, it just speaks to you in a way so immediately, he said, mistrust it.
Confirms all of your assumptions.
He says, immediately questioning. He's so totally right. So it turns out, and then, and the second part of this was, okay, so she claims she's raped. She's taken to the hospital by her dad. She is indeed, it's been shown that she's had you know, sexual intercourse, or anyway, we won't go into it. He then is transferred to another school where
he does
apparently another incident happens in a bathroom. And the father, we find out about this and it goes viral because the father is at a school board meeting yelling about this policy that had his daughter wait and the school was denied it. And then he
meeting.
Was, and then he's called a transphobe for being against, you know, mixed bathrooms. So it turns out that, as we should have expected, this story is more nuanced. And Kathy Young, who's a great writer, she was writing in ARC Digital. She's a great reporter, too. She points out that during, the boy was found guilty, and he is referred to as a man throughout this, or in a juvenile court, the equivalent of a guilty verdict. But it said during the hearing, the 15-year-old victim testified she had had consensual sexual encounters with the defendant on two occasions in a girl's bathroom at Stonebridge High School. And she testified that she and her attacker had agreed to meet up in the school bathroom around 12:15 on the date of the assault. And they were in the handicap bathroom and she invited him into it. And then that's where she then claimed, you know, she told him she did not want sex, but he assaulted her anyway.
So right there, think about it. When I first read the story, my impression was this girl had some stranger in a dress came into the right. bathroom, a trans person, and committed this heinous crime. It turns out it was more complicated.
Right. And it's not to say, look, if it happened and he was found guilty
of
doing this, it's a rape is a rape, even if you've had consensual sex. But on the other hand, it is not at all. And it's not even clear that this guy identifies as a trans person.
No,
that was the other thing. He could be wearing a skirt, as Kathy points out, because he's it's not even clear he's so-called.
We just don't know.
We just don't know.
The other thing is, one thing that was infuriating, inconceivable about the story as I first understood it, was that not only did all this apparent crime occur, a crime did occur, but not the one we think. We were told that the school was going to handle it in-house.
Right.
And that somehow that led me to believe that it wasn't going to be reported to the police, it was reported to the police. And in-house right. maybe referred to their own police force. I guess they have. But it just wasn't what it appeared to be. The story is more complicated. And I think we have to wait until the truth comes out, as more did when they had the hearing. And it's not to say that nothing bad happened. It's not to say that the school is completely off the hook, because I think the members of the school board also kind of didn't want to disclose much information about it because they were uncomfortable that it had happened in the bathroom.
Right.
There was possibility it was a non-binary student. So they weren't completely forthcoming. So there's a lot of, just bad behavior in terms of how this story got
out. Right. But the narrative that we all thought it was just too tidy, and it made too much, trans woman attacks girl in bathroom, school attempts to cover it up to protect their radical agenda.
And then a parent is dramatically removed from the meeting because he's protesting for his daughter's.
I know. And I still felt for the guy.
Any father.
My speculation is that because the reason it got found out is somebody came into the bathroom and reported it. Now, knowing teenagers, you also wonder if there hadn't been something consensual going on, but when caught, it was like, Dad, no, I'm serious. Right. I was being attacked, Dad. father didn't look like the kind of father you wanted to admit.
You could wonder if she's even telling the truth and she's just trying to get out of some embarrassing situation.
Right.
Then, as Kathy said, what gives credibility to her claim, further credibility, is that he went on and did it at another school.
Yeah.
Although we still don't know what was it. And she reminds us of Mattress Girl at Columbia University. And one reason people believed her was that other girls had come forward with stories, but all those stories fell apart.
Right.
I think in the end, Columbia had to settle the case with him. And
they did. He was found innocent.
He was always found. Yeah, not he was guilty.
Not, and then I think
they had to settle. He sued them. But what's happened to Mattress Girl? You never hear from her. She was a sort of New York Times celebrity.
Yeah,
and she carried her mattress.
Maybe she's selling mattresses. Maybe
she works for the State of the Union.
Maybe she works for mattress discounters. I like this one because it's really lightweight.
I just bought a new mattress. I realized, everybody out there, check your mattresses because nothing is wrong with it. But I think it might be 15 or 20 years old.
Yeah, you know, you're supposed to rotate them and everything. But
yeah, I did that. But anyway, I've got.
Well, see if you can get us a mattress sponsor. I'll carry it around. We'll carry it around.
They're so heavy.
Memory foam is heavy. All right. Well, Christina, thanks for coming up top. Yes, thanks for the virtual cocktails. And I'll try next time we watch TV
I won't overserve you.
You'd say even overserving. I think one glass television, I'm gone. Sorry.
What about if I give you whiskey?
Oh, I think it's the same. Maybe I could stay awake with whiskey, but.
We'll try.
All right. Thanks for joining. Okay. So now we're going to go to Amy. And just before I bring on Amy, just a reminder that if you're enjoying this podcast and you want to support us, we'd be really grateful. We survive on your donations and subscriptions to Patreon. And you get to be a friends with benefits. It's not just a one-sided relationship. That if you become a member at patreon.com/femsplainers, you'll not only get our monthly newsletter and a monthly bonus episode in which you get to ask our guests the questions, but you can also, at certain levels, get this weekly podcast early and ad-free. So again, please consider supporting the podcast at patreon.com/femsplainers. And having said that, we'll go to an ad and then bring on Amy.
This is Walk-Ins Welcome with Bridget Fettesy.
I love hearing people's stories of resilience and grit. This is why I created this podcast.
We are very excited to welcome Jim Gaffigan,
Yasmin Mohammed,
Glenn Beck,
Tim Dillon,
Abigail Schreier,
Jeff Garland,
Ayan Hirsi Ali,
Sam Harris,
Heather Hying,
Jonah Goldberg,
Ben Shapiro,
Glenn Greenwald,
Sarah Shahi,
Colin Quinn.
If there's a culture of victimhood, then let's tell stories of grit and survival.
Subscribe and listen now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Amy, welcome to the Femsplainers.
Thanks so much for having me, Danielle.
I have wanted to have you on for so long, and you couldn't resist the news hook of the 10th anniversary of the publication of the Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mom.
Not exactly the way I wanted to make a big splash with that, but yeah.
Well, the funny thing about you, not so funny, is you are just this brilliant thinker. You're obviously a brilliant legal professor and lawyer, and you've written these very serious books, the most recent being Political Tribes, Group Instinct, and the Fate of Nations. But the Tiger Mom just is in our culture now. It's been adopted into TV shows. It's referenced. It's just a cultural reference now. Were you ready for that? Did you expect that to happen?
No, it's so funny. I was so naive about this. This is 10 years ago exactly. And, you know, I'd written like foreign policy books. And my first couple books, they took me, I don't know, like 3.5 years each to write, like with research, and I had all these research assistants. Plus I have writer's block. So every day, like I, you know, crank out one paragraph. But in this case, and there's a little backstory because I actually wrote it when my younger daughter rebelled. I just wrote the whole thing on a lark in about 3 months, the first, at least the first two thirds of it. And I thought it was going to be so funny. And I remember people saying, wait, I think this could be controversial. And I thought it was going to be so literary. And I love unreliable narrators. And I thought, oh, it's a little bit like Nabokov. And it just took on a life of its own. And so ever since then, that's mostly how people know me.
Well, so how old were you? You have two daughters. How old were they 10 years ago when you began writing this?
So my oldest daughter is exactly 10 years younger. Sorry, I was 30 when I had her. So she's just turned 29. And so she would have been about, you know, when I started writing it, she was like 17. I remember she was just applying to college. And it was so bad and so controversial. I kept thinking, gosh, maybe because of my hubris, she won't get in anywhere. Because I remember one article said, well, we'll see if these schools, you know, what they want to say about this, if they accept this model of parenting. And, you know, so they were about, I would say, 18 and, you know, 15 when the book
came
out.
So they were teenagers. And actually, that's probably the most awkward moment to
horrible
release such a book.
I remember a good friend of mine said, you know, maybe you shouldn't release this while, because when I wrote it, she was like 14, my younger one, and I was having so many problems with her. And I said, oh no, I asked them and they said it was okay. They're really, you know, they're excited about it. And my friend said, wait, Amy, you're the lawyer, but they can't legally consent at this age. You know? But I was just, again, I always have been very overconfident. But you're right. It was crazy because I was still we were just coming through a really hard time, especially with my younger daughter. And suddenly we're in the middle of this global firestorm. We're called the most notorious household, you know, in the Western Hemisphere. There are reporters hiding in the bushes at their high school, trying to get, you know, find dirt. And it was really such an intense time.
And was this something that you, these methods, and you were basing them on, I guess, your own parents, sort of more traditional Chinese child rearing, much stricter than we're used to in the West. Did you take that approach throughout their early childhood, or did it start to happen in reaction to their more rebellious teenage years?
I was hardcore from the beginning. You know, I remember I think it's more normal and probably thoughtful to be a very anxious parent. that kind of hit me later. My situation is I'm one of four daughters. I'm the oldest of four daughters. And I'm really lucky my parents are both still alive. They're 85, living in Berkeley. And they were immigrants. And they parented in a way that's very, very typical of immigrants, not just from Asia, but also from, like, you know, Nigeria or Jamaica or Ireland or anywhere, you know. And that's because they basically were afraid that we couldn't survive. So it was kind of like, you've got to do well in school, you know. And they would say things that probably would horrify most Americans. Like, if you don't get an A, you're going to be out on the streets, you know. And much, much stricter than I ever was socially, because my parents were outsiders. My mother could barely speak English, and she couldn't even understand the concept of the sleepover. I remember she said, wait, but we have a bed for you here, Amy. Why do you want to go to someone else's house to sleep? You know? And she was afraid. So
you're insulting your mother by going on a sleepover.
But even though my sisters and I all kind of complained, why do we have all these crazy rules? Fast forwarding to our adulthood, I think we just all felt it really worked. You know, we felt like, geez, we all came out with a lot of confidence and a lot of grit. I mean, this ability to take a lot of hits, you know, fail and pick yourself up. And four of us really felt we had a lot of opportunities. So I just felt like, look, it worked. And my husband would like kill me for saying this, but his family was, they were a very progressive Jewish family. kind of the opposite model, really 1960s, do whatever you want, pursue your passions. You don't even, have to go to school or wear clothes. His dad was smoking pot, and they all came out. They're just wonderful individuals, but the family was much more dysfunctional. I mean, the parents divorced, and at one point, no one person was talking to anybody else. And so my husband kind of went along because he was much more thoughtful and questioning about it. And I was just this overconfident person. So from day one, I just had this kind of, I'm going to do exactly what my parents did. And the thing is, with my oldest daughter, it worked. It was so easy. She was this really rule-abiding, easy kid. And I got really cocky. I was like, why doesn't everybody do this? And then 3 years later, my number two came along, and boy, did I get my comeuppance. I mean, you have kids. Kids can be, how different they can be. I mean, this one was just like, just came out screaming no, basically. she was kicking even when I was pregnant with her, came out. She had like colic for like 3 years, wouldn't roll over, wouldn't do anything, didn't satisfy any markers. And, from a young age said, I want to be a witch. I'm not going to college. I want to be a garbage man. So we just kind of, it was most 3/4 of the book is pretty funny, I think, because it's about these wars. And if you read between the lines, you realize that she always wins. So in a way, the book is also, I think it's a much more subtle book than people get. In a way, I think it's a celebration of the rebel, because Lulu is my rebel daughter. And at the end of the book, I reveal that my father's a rebel and it was the black sheep and actually hated his own family. So, and the whole book is written in this very rebellious tone against conventional Western parenting. But then when Lulu becomes 13, you mentioned teenage years, she had a total adolescent rebellion, like so many teenagers universally. And that was just, things became very dark and not funny. And my third sister got leukemia and had to have a bone marrow transplant. And I went through a really dark, really dark period where I thought I was going to lose my family. I questioned everything. And there was one blow up scene in Russia of all places where I really literally thought I'd lost my daughter, Lulu. I mean, it was just like a screaming blow up fight where she said some of the harshest things anyone has ever said to me. And I've heard a lot of bad things about myself. My daughter still takes the cake. And after that, I decided I had to kind of change or at least pull back. So that's when I started writing the book, the day after that blow up fight. And so that's the story of how it got to be written. I think what happened was the Wall Street Journal excerpted the most controversial parts of the book and slapped this headline on. I think it was called Why Chinese Mothers Are Superior. And it just blew up. It just blew up because people didn't even realize that it was actually a memoir where at the end there's this rebellion and a kind of like, oh my gosh, maybe I did it wrong. How do we combine the best of East and West? And you got to pay attention to your, the individual personalities of your children. All that was lost. It was just like, why Chinese mothers are superior. After that, it just, that's still the headline that people remember. A lot of people don't even know it is a book.
Right. Well, it was definitely, I remember when it came out and my kids were probably about the same age. One was a little younger than yours, so we had a third child. And it was just very anxious making because you just felt, because you're also aware that Chinese students just do consistently score off the charts. And so you have these sort of sloppy Western attitudes, these lovey-dovey attitudes, and you try and be a disciplinarian. But honestly, I had a very fierce-willed first child. And that took me by complete surprise. As you say, each one as they come requires their own operating system as a parent. So you have, and unfortunately, when the first one is the rebel, you have all these ideas about as you say, well, I'm just going to be stricter. She's not going to get better than me. You're grounded for 9 years. you know, don't leave your room. I'm taking your computer away. Like, right. I just did everything. And it was a total nightmare. And so I was thinking, like, I was so impressed, Amy, like, well, how did Amy do it? Like, if I tried to do some of the things that you did, my kids would just like laugh at me or they wouldn't do it. I you know, and then yeah. even when I did try to be fierce, it just backfired.
Yeah, I think first of all, that kind of did happen to me with my second child. So I think we just had a reverse wake up call, you know, because trust me, I mean, I was like, it's not even, the book is pretty crazy about those fights, but that's not even the half of it. You know, I used to say, you know, Lulu, I know you're going to be an amazing star someday, but my job is just to keep you out of jail. You know, but part of it is because I probably had this belief because I was raised that way myself. But I think that you're exactly right about the timing because people said, wait a minute, Amy, why is this book creating such waves? Like, it's just one person's story. And I think that the timing was crazy because I think a lot of Western, it was like a tipping point. I think a lot of Western parents, even independently, it felt that the pendulum had maybe swung too far. Like right now we hear all this talk about snowflakes and whatever, but this was like 10 years ago. None of that was really being talked about yet. And then right before my book came out, these international test scores came out, you know, those rankings yes. of math, reading, and science. And it was like, the top five was like, you know, China, Hong Kong, Japan, Korea, you know, and Finland. And then the US was like number 33 below all the European countries, you know, below Canada. And so I think it was this thing. I remember a friend said, you know what I think, Amy? I think you, it was that perfect firestorm where, you know, fear of parenting hits fear of China. And you just like hit that intersection and it just blew up.
Right, right. Well, okay. So now 10 years on, like the big question us anxious parents all want to know. So how did it turn out? Are your daughters like tidy academic stars who have gone on for just enviable, successful lives that we're all going to feel bad, you know?
I think for me, the most important thing is that we are really close friends. You know, my oldest daughter just got married at our house 3 weeks ago on September 25th. And I thought, oh my God, my two daughters used to fight. And that was another sense of failure that I carried with me for a while. What if after all my parenting, my two daughters hate each other? But you know, 10 years later, the almost most important thing is that we're all friends. And my daughter Lulu was maid of honor and gave this beautiful speech and everybody was sobbing. And that just meant more than anything to me that, you know, that the two of them were close and that our family is close. But I guess that one thing I want to say is I have this kind of strict Chinese parenting thing. It's supposed to be about early childhood parenting. Like the ideal is that you instill all this grit in them. And then by the time, you know, you kind of try to phase it out by the time that they're 15, 16. And I was very true to that. Like, unlike a lot of other parents, believe it or not, once my kids went to college, I was completely hands off. I didn't even go to that parents weekend or whatever. I let them major on whatever, you know, whatever they want to do. I knew that other parents were helping them edit their essays and giving them advice. I didn't do any of that. They came out great. You know, my oldest daughter, well, they both went to law school. My oldest daughter came to Yale Law School, which I think we actually regret for different reasons now. She should have gone somewhere else. And she also did ROTC. So she is actually a JAG Army lawyer out in Tacoma right now. I know.
That's impressive. That's really impressive.
I'm really proud of her, but that's not the career I would have chosen. And I'm so terrified about our foreign policy now for different reasons, you know, And then my youngest daughter is a 3L at Harvard Law School, and she's totally her own person.
How did she come through this rebellion? How did you two together come through this, her rebellion, and come out the other end friends?
We had honestly, years 10 through 18 were so crazy. I'm amazed we didn't kill each other. I mean, you talk about, like, go to your room. I mean, I was only half joking. I'm going to see this dollhouse. I'm about to throw it out the window. You know, I mean, it's like,
I've been there. Don't, you know, it got to that point.
And she is exactly like my personality. She fought back and she, you know, she pulled out all the stops. And so when I wrote the Tiger Mom book, I actually radically pulled back when she was about 14. I let her drop the violin. I stopped. I kind of let her completely go be social and go anywhere, as many play dates as you want. I just held fast on the academics. I guess I just couldn't let that go. And so I was very tough about that. And I would say that parenting is just, it just never gets easy. I mean, even now, you know, I have gotten tougher. I now realize my goal now is to be the punching bag, just I'll get a call. And I will be so panicked. You know, I'm so miserable. I'm so depressed. What am I going to do? I'm like, should I just drive there, drop everything, you know, cancel class? Right before the wedding, you know, my daughter, oldest daughter was like, look at this hair. I put you in charge of one thing. Look at this hair.
You had one job, Mom.
I know. And of course, afterwards, it's sorry. So now I think, you know, ironically, I'm much more their friend. Yeah. But I wasn't like that when they were little. I was very disliked, I would say. Not always, but I.
Yeah, you know, I remember we were fairly strict, but we actually just recently had a show talking about growing up in the 70s where your parents basically let you run feral, very much, I think, to your husband's upbringing. Yeah. So there's a part of us who that you sort of want to replicate. It did give you a lot of independence, for better or worse.
Yes.
So I just always felt I wanted my children to be able to, like, ride a public bus, you know, at age 10, you know, things that would shock our American neighbors. But you wanted them to have that sense of independence and resilience, as you say, and not solve their problems. My kids' art projects were always the most obviously their own, you know, and
that's
second
grade.
Yeah. But then, and you'd say this to the teachers, you say, look, I completed second grade. I don't need to do the art projects. And I just really want you to know that what they turn in is theirs. You say that, like, at the beginning of the year. And then, wow, was that cruel? We should have moved in there because they'd have these sad little,
earnest
projects. And then there'd be, like, next to, I don't know, professional prop makers or something.
Seriously. No, I think you did the right thing. And I think that is actually kind of what we're a big problem with America right now. Like, people, well-meaning parents. I made a joke in Battle Hymn about, you know, you could kind of tell whose parents were the architects. Because,
yes.
You know,
yes.
It's like, that looks like a building, you know,
yes.
Not a school project. And I don't know that that does build strength. I don't. I think that you did exactly the right thing in a way.
Well,
you know?
they were sad, but they did... But they didn't, you know, I had that strong feeling from I think you do adopt things from your own upbringing. And I was always appreciated that I was treated, you know, with this kind of independence and given these responsibilities at an early age.
Do you know that I just learned that with college admissions now, there is such a big problem of, you know, really high powered parents essentially writing these essays for their kids that it's actually now much better to have an essay that is filled, as you say, the sad looking essay, filled with even mistakes and typos and grammatical errors, that at least just looks like it's their own product. Apparently,
right.
That's like the new thing, because if you have these really canned looking things, everybody just assumed that you hired somebody to do it. So
yeah,
so
and I'm sure that's happening. Well,
yeah.
So you've come through this, and you're right, you're never not the mother, even as they get older. And I still have seizures if things aren't going right in any of my children's lives. I sort of, what are you? You're like the canary in the coal mine, or what is the thing that exhibits the disease, you know, that you're always the one who's anxious. But
they say you're only as happy as your least happy child.
That is so, so true. So there, here we are, but you now... I'm curious because you've had some interesting times lately at Yale, And you've watched, I guess, a newer generation come up. And do you see, let's talk about some of the differences in the student. Do you see these kinds of changes? Do you see students unable to cope for themselves or do?
It's completely different. Yes. So I'm actually very fascinated by Gen Z. I might even write something about it. I'm trying to not just be that old person that's complaining, but actually trying to understand. And I'll tell you, I have students who are my 3L students who are still millennials, and they'll say to me, I just can't understand the 1Ls. Like, it's like a completely, you know, almost like a different planet. But
this is like the older millennials who came of age during the worst recession, like 2007, 2008. And they're in their 30s.
Well, I'm actually just talking about people who are like 28 versus people who are 23. Yes. You know, these guys do TikTok, but we don't. And, I think there are teaching now is unrecognizable. So I've taught for 30 years. And for about, 23 of them, it was always the same. Now it's just... it's a completely different scene. We begin the school year at Yale Law School with, you know, just mental health training instead of like, oh, here's some provocative debates. Let's start with that. It's a lot of training, diversity and inclusion training, coaching about what you should or shouldn't say. And we all are instructed, like, there's certain things that we shouldn't talk about. And, you know, what our syllabus should look like and things that could offend students. And I used to love, even up until 5 years ago, my favorite thing was, I'm very proud that my classes are well known for being the absolute most genuinely diverse classes. By genuinely diverse, I mean in every sense, like it includes politically diverse. I have a lot of conservative students in there. But because of who I am, I also have like tons of women of color and immigrants' kids and, you know, first generation professional kids, you know, kids whose parents didn't go to high school. And I used to love just having these provocative debates and people would get really all heated. But then afterwards, everybody would go for a beer. Never again. At least not right now. Now, it just, I used to have students who are conservatives become great friends with real liberals. Now, no communication. It's very tribal. If you're very progressive and you make friends with somebody on the right, then you are, you know, you're a traitor. You're not part of the tribe anymore. You're FedSoc adjacent. So FedSoc is Federal Society, the conservative group. If you are liberal and have a friend from FedSoc, you are FedSoc adjacent, and you get like shamed. So there's a lot more anger and polarization, but there's also so much more sensitivity. We have a new dean now, just for this, that it's like an administrative position, you know, 2 or 3 people, but anytime a student has a problem, instead of just talking to the other student, like, let's talk this out, you run to this dean and you file this complaint, and then they're hauled in. And I think it's extremely dysfunctional. I mean, there are a lot of positive reasons for it too. I do understand. I think there are a lot of changes for the better. There's a lot of inappropriate comments that shouldn't be made or are hopefully not made now or less so. But I think it's been an overcorrection. I mean, I wouldn't have students over even for parties, people might feel too, I don't hold them anymore because some people might feel too much pressure. You know, is there pressure to drink? Is there pressure to be impressive? So it's, you know, I just do it now. Like, let's just go all for tea, you know, and I'm much more careful about what I say. So it's a really different time.
Yeah, I want to ask you about that as well in your personal sense that what you've gone through, but just in a general sense as a generation, it is true. I mean, you are self-conscious about sounding like an angry old person. And I don't know what's wrong with this generation. Yeah. But as you say, the 28-year-olds are saying it about the 21-year-olds. It is statistically very worrying. I mean, the levels of anxiety, of suicide, that they're not having sex, which could be a good thing from some perspectives, but they seem to be just shying away from it entirely. The loneliness,
Yes. I've never seen my students so unhappy as a group. So it does make me wonder whether a lot of these policies and new institutions and new bureaucratic offices that we've installed are actually helping, because I mean, maybe it would be even worse if we didn't have all these measures, but I just kind of feel like we've taken a wrong direction. I mean, I've never seen my students so not just anxious and stressed and unhappy, but also terrified to speak. So I will, you know, I ask my students to submit a reaction paper every week. And for the first time in 30 years, they'll write all this interesting stuff, but say, can I please not be asked to share this part because I'm afraid of being canceled? Or, you know, I don't want to cause any waves. So there's a lot of fear and stress now, and people are worried, am I being recorded? Is somebody going to tape me and put me on the wall? So I feel something is off the rails right now.
Right. But it's not just happening at college. It's happening before they get to college. I mean, they're just being streamed in this way. Do you think it has anything to do with parenting? I mean, have you noticed a change in the way that you deal with the parents? Are the parents different or behaving differently from how they might have 10 years ago?
In this case, I don't think so. I don't know, because my students are much older. My students are
right. You're a graduate.
Yeah. Yeah. But I kind of don't think so. Maybe it happened at the schools, but I honestly know this is another thing I might be writing about. It's such a revolution right now that I have a lot of parents whose kids are younger than mine. They're 15, 16. And my friends, the parents say, I don't understand them. You know, I can't talk to them. You know, it's a really big difference. Just as you were saying, just the percentage of children who identify as non-binary, very different. You know, they're all going through anti-white training. A lot of them just have very, very critical views of our generation, what the boomers did and all the climate change, the mess we left them. So I think it's a real generational revolution right now that we're seeing. That's actually, I think Gen Z is going to drive some form of societal transformation. I think, you know, the Overton window is going to shift a little bit to the left considerably. I think it's like the 60s in a way.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I remember when you look back on those who were rebelling, I mean, the boomers grew up in these post-war, you know, seemingly idyllic households with, you know, mom at home and they just went nuts. And especially to the generation that had fought in the war, you know, that although to be fair, then they faced in the United States, I grew up in Canada, they faced, of course, Vietnam, but it was this kaboom. And maybe that is what we're seeing right now with Gen Zers. Tell us now a little bit what you've been through. You've been, in addition to all of this stepping around, tiptoeing in your teaching, which I can't imagine a tiger professor doing, but tell us about what you've been through. There were two incidents, one involving Brett Kavanaugh and the other, these dinner parties. And going back to what you said, I mean, part of, and you're at graduate school, so you're not with undergraduates. The part of being, knowing you, having you as a teacher is also connection and learning how things work and meeting people like that is amazing. And you can't do that anymore.
So I guess the first thing I'll say is I feel so lucky. I don't feel like a victim. You know, I know I put myself in the public eye and, you know, that's, you know, it's like everything is on me. But yeah, I've had a couple of really surreal experiences. I always tell my students, you know, the bigger the humiliation now, the better the story later. back in 2018, when I was kind of flying high, I actually just had some great interactions with your husband of The Atlantic. And I thought, wow, I'm finally done with this Tiger Mom thing. People are not even...
Your book, right. He reviewed your book.
And we did some stuff. And I was like, now people remember that I write about foreign policy and I'm finally done with being the worst mom in the world. So then after I actually wrote Political Tribes, which predicted the rise of President Donald Trump, you know, so it was, that book was kind of interesting. And Once again, I got cocky. But then in the summer of 2018, Brett Kavanaugh was nominated for the Supreme Court. And I have sent many, not just me, but all, he was, this is going to sound crazy, but he was absolutely beloved at Yale Law School. He was known, this may surprise you, as the moderate Republican. And every admissions, you know, when it was admissions kind of admit students day, the dean would bring him in and he would talk to the Black Students Association and the Yale Law women, and because he was just this alum that everybody loved, you know. So some, I, you know, we all sent a lot of students to him, and a lot of students, women students who just loved him as a mentor, said, "Professor Chu, will you write a piece about his mentorship?" So I did. This is before any allegations came out. And this piece came out in the Wall Street Journal. And I said, this is not about politics, but just what I can say. And right then I said that my oldest daughter is going to be clerking for him, because she had been hired by him through completely different mentors before Donald Trump was even elected president. So this all happened a long time ago. So I wrote this piece, and then all of these allegations came out. And at the same time, I went into the hospital with this. As a Tiger mom, I've never been sick in my life, but I got this freak hole in my colon and had to have a colostomy. And I was in the hospital for, you know, 6 weeks, or, sorry, 5 weeks. And all this happened at the exact same time. And suddenly I come out of the hospital and I notice that I'm in the news, and it's Amy Chua is told students to dress like models for breakup. And it was so insane, so stupid, and also very upsetting, because it was the opposite. I mean, he's a member of the Federal Society, and it is such dumb advice. Like, you know, the Federal Society is conservative, and they all have this kind of uniform, which is dark suits. So if you're going to try to interview with this judge in a courthouse, what I would always say is dress conservatively, lower the hems, dark suit, low heels, you know. And I know where this comment came from, because I made a stupid comment at a coffee shop about 1 year. Everybody was talking about it. I was like, oh, I made a comment about his, you know, that he had three clerks and they were all really attractive. And I said, you know, people were commenting on that. And I said that, you know, that his clerks were all really nice looking. And I said, but of course, it has nothing to do with anything remotely, you know, negative or sordid. He is the best mentor. He's like an uncle. And that's the one comment. So then it came out, and I think it was part of, people were so angry. It was part of this political tribalism. It was like after Merrick Garland, which I, by the way, I thought he should have been on the Supreme Court, and they're friends, by the way. I think it was just everybody was so angry at what was happening that, you know, anything to bring this guy down. And I was just kind of swept up in this thing. And after that, it's never been the same at Yale Law School. I mean, there are just people who will not take my classes. And so most of my faculty supported him. But after the allegations came out, there was this student protest, and everybody was asked to recant. Sounds like a cultural revolution, to withdraw their support. Yeah. And every single person did, except for me. They said denounce him, and I just said I just refuse to. You know, I just don't turn on my friends like that. I just said, look, I stand by, I'm not commenting on anything else, I haven't, but I stand by my op-ed, and I still do. You know, it's just about his mentorship. And that's cost me, you know, a good support of some members of the student body, but that's kind of who I am, and at least I can be true to myself. I mean, I just, that's just kind of me. But then I came back and I survived that. And, you know, my classes again had, I'll just have to say this, but they're the longest wait list of any class offered at the Yale Law School. And some people won't take my classes, but they're still very popular classes. And I thought, okay, I've moved, this is last spring, I've moved past things. The Kavanaugh thing is finally past me. I'm teaching again. I had perfect reviews. I love my students, super diverse. And then this past spring, another crazy thing happened. I get this email in March from the Yale Daily News saying, oh, so the administration had begged me to teach this small group, which is like this group of 16 1Ls, and you have to socialize and have them to your house. I didn't want to do it, but they begged and begged, and I finally agreed. And without any advance warning, the Yale Daily News sends me an email saying, do you have any comment on the fact that you're about to be stripped of your small group because you've been hosting drunken dinner parties at your house with federal judges during, I was like, what? I thought it was a joke. Anyway, I won't go into the details, but let's just say that I emailed my dean and are you going to support me? No. And so the first thing I did is I've done something that I've never done before. I basically listened to my Gen Z daughter because they did take the small group away from me. And there was this totally 100% false Yale Daily News piece about me. And my daughter, I was just going to let it go. Like, I don't even care about the small group, But my younger daughter says, my generation, we get the truth from social media. And if you're saying it's false, you've got to fight back. So I did something I've never done in my life. I wrote a letter, irate letter, angry letter to the faculty, and then I tweeted it. And then it just took on a life of its own. Danielle, you were nice to retweet it, but so did a lot of other people. And so I ended up just fighting. It's been a 6-month fight. And I feel it was probably one of the most unpleasant things that's ever happened to me. Like 3/4 of my faculty stopped talking to me. Many of them still won't talk to me. And it was just this horrible cloud. Like, is she hosting these drunken dinner parties? The administration kept changing its story after they finally realized that there were no dinner parties. They were relying on this completely concocted document. They were embarrassed and they changed it like a totalitarian regime. They're like, oh, we never mentioned anything about dinner parties. It was actually a COVID violation. Oh, that's why.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I do feel I'm done. I feel vindicated. I feel like, it's still a good country. I've renewed faith in journalism. There was a piece by Liz Brunig in The Atlantic that pretty much says, nope, none of that ever happened. And once again, my lit lists are the longest. I mean, I have a great class now. I feel like most people now don't think that I hosted any dinner parties with any judge. And trust me, I didn't.
I would want to sign up for your class if I read that my professor was, and I wouldn't like rat you out. I think that sounds like a lot of fun.
Oh, don't get me wrong. I think it's great. What I was saying was like, I've thrown so many amazing parties and I think it's great for professors to throw dinner parties. And the administration just made the mistake of picking something 100% false in this case,
because it was
at the height of COVID. I was like wearing sweats all day. There were, with a mask, like not a time to be having a wild dinner party.
But it must be so difficult for you to be in this like gotcha atmosphere. It was, first with Brett Kavanaugh and now people, do you feel that especially this dinner party accusation that it's like kind of politically motivated? Do you think it was payback for supporting Brett Kavanaugh?
Yeah, that actually came out in some of the, I just focused on the administration, but journalists later kind of, what's interesting is the students who were criticizing me had never met me. And then I produced 60 pages of very supportive student emails, which actually were so moving. It made the whole thing worth it because when I say I produced, like I didn't do anything. There was another rumor that I wrote them myself, but some students started this movement and I just ended up having a student collect them and I posted them on my website. But yeah, I do feel that I have a little bit of a target on my back and it's never going to be like it was, but life goes on and I think my students will be self-selected and I always get still, I love my current group. But it's very different. Going back to your original point, it's a really different time to be on a university campus. It's just, it's people are afraid to speak. A really smart student of mine, whom I love, said to me, Professor Chu, you're just of a different generation. You assume that engagement is a good thing, that it's good for one side to engage with the other. Like that needs to be interrogated. It's not clear. So there's really a big change in attitude. I always thought, of course, you want to argue and have debates. Yeah. And,
especially as a lawyer training. I mean, that's what you have to do.
Yeah, no, it's quite different.
How do you look back now on the whole Kavanaugh hearing and what happened and what you made of the allegations, even in retrospect?
Well, I completely stand by everything I said. I think it, you know, I don't want to comment on the specifics of the whole thing, but as I say, it was, it was interesting that I was writing about political tribalism because I thought that was a perfect example of the confirmation process just being the perfect representation of the worst kind of political tribalism. And nobody acquitted themselves well, I thought. And, you know, we'll see what happens. I mean, for me, look, my position was just, I have known and worked closely with this man for, you know, 10 years. And that's all that I spoke to. So I wouldn't take back a word of the op-ed piece. And what's really interesting now is I read all this stuff about court decisions. And just because I'm a lawyer and know a little bit about it, you know, often these Supreme Court cases turn on one boring procedural little issue. But when it's reported in the press, it's always what's going to get the most clicks and generate the most hate. So we'll see. It's definitely a really, I'm just glad that I don't teach constitutional law. So I don't really have to talk about this in my class. I teach international business transactions instead. And, you know, thank goodness, but I try to kind of steer clear of that whole thing because it's really still just such a lightning rod.
Well, and it's, I mean, just as a precedent, I remember, I think also because Trump was in office, everybody was a little oversteamed on all sides, you know, and he became, and at the, simultaneously with Me Too. So it was a lightning rod. And I remember feeling very angry about him and not thinking he should be on the Supreme Court, even though now when I look back on it, think, well, we have no idea if that happened. You know, we have, should something that happened, you know, when you're 19, like all the questions that it raised just as a legal precedent.
I think that's right. Due process is very important. And you're right. I mean, most of my friends felt exactly like you, liberals and conservatives. They were very, very angry and didn't think that it presented itself well. But one really interesting book is not the one by the right-wing reporters, but the one that was produced by the two New York Times reporters, you know, about a year later, because you'll see that just proves your point. I mean, these are people who were wanting to kind of really come out against him. And in the end, they actually said what you said, that there is no evidence or not one witness or not one person other than the accuser. And just in terms of setting precedent, we do want to be careful. You know, I know now a lot of women in your position with sons who are 16. I mean, this is something about something that happened in high school. One incident reported in high school. And so you do want some form of due process. Otherwise, it's. I think it's not just going to be good for anybody. And I do think people are starting to maybe be able to separate out some of the emotions that were so intense at the time from some of these larger issues.
Right. And we're seeing it as always, when these things get out of control, they start to eat their own. And you're experiencing this on, you know, many people are experiencing this on campuses now. So just looking ahead, do you see this thing cooling down at all, or these terrible campus wars that we read about? Or
Actually, you know, I am ever the optimist, but I do think that it's not going to be a complete transformation. You know, as we said, there's a very large shift in kind of generational thinking, entirely different views about what is normal psychological well-being and just, you know, and I think that I'm interested in learning, again, just not being that kind of whiny, you know, older person, you toughen up. So I have a lot of research assistants, kind of really, you know, I think Gen Z and the younger generations can look at a lot of things that our generations did wrong. You know, there's so much student debt and, you know, the environment, whatever. But I think if you look at the last, lately there was another thing called, involving a Native American student. I'm not really very involved, but it was, again, the same two actors that basically said something like, you know, if you, I don't know, it's been in the news, and it was just a complete lack of due process, where they were going to write an apology for him and they were telling the black students one thing.
Yes, yeah. Yes, and he refused. Yes.
Yes, he refused, but they wrote one for him, and he taped this. And it was so kind of ridiculous that it made once again kind of national news. But I think that that might be a good sign that you'll see that Ruth Marcus of the Washington Post, who is a very, very liberal person, she was extremely against Brett Kavanaugh. You'll see that her post is, you know, she says Yale Law School has nothing on the Maoist revolution. I mean, she's very critical of what's happening on campuses. So I'm not saying that none of the more recent changes are good. I think we want to kind of take out best practices. I think a lot of things have changed for the better. But I think that, again, there might have been an overcorrection, just over pampering, oversensitivity. And with this last crazy thing, I think maybe we'll see like a slight correction back. That's what I'm hoping. So I have a big banner on my syllabus that's a little unusual, which says only take this class if this class is, you know, dedicated to promoting lively debate among people of all different political views and backgrounds. And basically, like, you know, if you're too sensitive for this, don't take this class. Yeah. And I really put my foot down, and it is the best class. I mean, it's super progressive. It's like 80% minorities, and, you know, and there's a big FedSoc contingent, and I'm not trying to romanticize it. There are tense moments. It's not like it used to be. It's not funny anymore, but I can do it. Like I put my foot down and we're going to do this. Nothing's exploded, you know, nothing is, people have not started crying. So I agree with you. I think, and there's this real new thing about, it is a little bit like the Cultural Revolution, which is like, denounce this person. You know, it's not enough. You know, you need the whole organization to denounce them. And if you don't denounce them, then you'll be targeted too. So yeah. it's a very, I think people are, yeah. The reason I think things are going to change is all the people who secretly come to my office hours and say they hate it. I think it's a very small vocal minority that is driving a lot of this. And there's a large silent majority that is actually very reasonable. I mean, I'm not saying that they're the same as previous generations, but they also think things have gone way too far.
Right. All right, Amy. Well, it is so wonderful to catch up with you. Thank you for joining us. We'll look forward to your next book, whatever it is. But I would love to see the Tiger Mom, the aftermath, the opposite of a battle hymn.
Maybe I should do that, or you know, maybe it'll be like grandmother, you know, of the Tiger.
Tiger grandmother.
Right. I know. Lessons learned. Thank you so much. It was really fun.
Thank you. Now that we're starting to ditch masking in public, you may have to confront the state of your smile. And by smile, I mean your teeth. How did they fare over these long months of COVID? Well, good health starts with good habits. And the good news is that Quip makes it easy by delivering all the oral care essentials you need to care for your mouth. The Quip electric toothbrush is loved by over 7 million mouths and has timed sonic vibrations with 30-second pulses to guide a dentist-recommended 2-minute clean, a lightweight and sleek design for adults and kids, with no wires or bulky charger to weigh you down. That's especially great if you're planning on resuming travel. It's portable and goes anywhere you do. And its multi-use travel cover doubles as a mirror mount for less clutter. And its reusable handles come in a range of very chic metal hues, including best-selling all black and all pink, as well as bright plastic colors, sure to make a pop to your bathroom counter. And already on top of your brushing, you can upgrade your Quip with a new smart motor to track and improve your brushing with a free Quip app and earn amazing rewards like free refills, products, Target gift cards, and more. Yes, just by brushing your teeth. And beyond the brush, Quip has everything you need to build a complete routine. They offer anti-cavity toothpaste in mint or watermelon, two ways to floss, including reusable floss picks that replace over 180 disposable picks with every refill, refillable gum, and refillable mouthwash. In addition to the brush heads, Quip also delivers their fresh floss, toothpaste, mouthwash, and gum refills every 3 months from just $5. Shipping is free, so you can save money and skip the hustle and bustle of in-store shopping while always knowing you will never be using an old, worn-out brush head. So with stylish and affordable electric brushes starting at just $25, you won't be paying through the teeth for better oral health. So if you go to getquip.com/femsplain right now, you'll get your first refill free. That's your first refill at getquip.com/femsplain. And that's spelled GETQIP.com/femsplain. Quip, the good habits company. Well, throughout that interview with Amy, young Natasha Panapinto, our intern, who is law school aspiring, is that fair to say, Natasha?
Yes, yes.
You sat in on that.
I have meetings with our law school advisors, so still the plan.
Okay, well, I wanted you to be there so you could hear and see this amazing person. She's clearly an incredible teacher because no matter what they try to do to her at the Yale Law School, she keeps bouncing back up. So, and her courses are popular. But what were your reactions, especially to some of the things she said about students who actually just a little older than you?
On the note of kids not being able to have conversations anymore and arguments in class, that is definitely something I've experienced already in undergrad as an issue that I definitely would see happening more in law school. And I honestly think that social media, specifically TikTok, is a huge contributor to that, of kids just scroll through and they'll see a video telling them to form their opinion and they'll form an entire opinion based on a quick video, where I think my Gen Z, with just the complete of constant influx of news, has almost rendered us impossible to make our own opinions on. We're losing that skill to really sit down and look through news and reach an opinion at the end, which I think is obviously key to law school. And if you can't be doing that there, then I don't think there's much hope for our future lawyers, let alone our future generation. So I think that social media, that was a big contributor to, I think, that decline in my generation.
That's interesting, because I have to say, you know, not to sound old, which I am, but you guys lost me at TikTok. Like, my kids all watch it, but you know, I got through to Snapchat, and then I thought, okay, I can't do TikTok. But you're right, it's these very short takes, and they have incredible influence. And you watch hundreds of them, but you don't sit and go through an issue. I mean, presumably you still have to do it in your schoolwork. You have to thoroughly research things and argue points. No?
Yes, but I feel like even now kids are doing research more with like just confirmation bias. Like, they're coming up with what they want their thesis to be, and they're just looking for anything to confirm their hypothesis, opposed to looking for things from all different areas that may say that their hypothesis was wrong. We really want to be right. Because we have so much access to different news, opposed to when you used to have to go to the library to do your research paper and read through all these books, that within the book, it would bring up separate points. Now you can find a billion articles in 5 minutes that all confirm your prior point of view.
Yeah, that's genuinely frightening. So how do you fight this or deal with it or counter it in your own studies or not?
What I started doing, at least over the pandemic, because we were spending so much time on our phone, of realizing that I was just like reposting things to my stories without really seeing like if it was true or where it came from. So I made an active effort, which I still do today, of trying to, before I share anything, I go and look the source, find it, find where it came from, who wrote it, if it actually is something reliable. So I think that's something just individually that each person, not just in my generation, but everyone should be checking their sources. But I think now, especially when there's so much news available all the time,
right, and so much
really need to be aware of that.
Literal fake news, as it were.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Actually, my husband David has a rule, and he's imparted it to our children, which is, first of all, if you really like something you see on the internet, assume it's fake or it's been geared to you. So just the very fact that it appeals to you so much is a warning sign. Yes. And the other is, when you see a video, what happened in the minute before and the minute after it was taken. And his basic assumption of any video that comes over, any viral video, is probably going to be found fake, you know, with very few exceptions. And so one should go in with that assumption before, as you say, believing it, let alone recirculating it.
Yeah. And that's where I think, honestly, she was talking about the whole like identity and how kids, Gen Z, are so much more likely to identify themselves as something different, whether it be their pronouns or their sexual like orientation. And I think that's, again, from TikTok. There's a billion. If you spend an hour, you could probably find 10 videos at least of someone coming out to the internet. And so I think that has increased then people that in some cases, yeah, definitely might be them figuring out their sexuality. But in other cases, it's a 10-year-old girl scrolling on an app, learning for the first time what being gay is and thinking, oh, that might apply to me. And then in a week, she'll post her own video when she doesn't have enough information or knowledge about herself to know that.
Right. And it's so how much of the time would you say, you can be honest, no one's listening, Natasha, as you know. do you spend like outside of your school studying hours, your parents aren't listening. How much would you say, like, what percentage of your time is devoted to TikTok versus any other form of social media, or even just watching or streaming TV shows?
So I recently actually did for my, I'm taking a digital media and politics class, and we had to do an ethnography on our own digital media usage like 2 weeks ago.
Wow. So you're prepared for this question.
Yes. Yes. And it was rather frightening. TikTok was definitely my most used, which was at about like 40 minutes to an hour a day. Yeah. And then Instagram was much lower. That was at like 10 minutes a day. But TikTok is definitely, that's my crutch on. It's mainly just like in between times. I don't think I go to the bathroom without scrolling through at least five TikToks. Like like, I think my generation's, if you have like a minute free in between things, it's like TikTok, like for some reason is like the break you need opposed to an actual break.
That's interesting. Yeah.
And I think that's created its own microcosm of like cancel culture, which has translated into obviously the real world of it, which started on, I see so many, there'll be one video and I'll see that some TikTok influencer is canceled off one video. And if you keep scrolling, then it's another video 20 minutes later on why they're canceled for a different reason or why they're not canceled. That it's made kids think that someone can get canceled for saying something they don't like. It's completely like taken over the movement, the term, and it's made it pretty much on social media almost mean like nothing at that level, because you can get canceled from calling someone out for not inviting you to a party to something all the way to calling someone a racial slur. The fact that canceling is the same response for all of that is not an acceptable thing.
Right. And it's also, I just recently watched the new Dave Chappelle special, The Closer. One thing he said that I really liked was he said he was getting at one point dragged all over Twitter. And he said, but that's fine because Twitter's not a real place. And if it's something we have to think of with Twitter and TikTok, that whatever is going on over there, you know, you should be able to shut that window. It's real and it isn't real.
Yeah. It is possible to just put the phone down and delete the app.
Right. Right. But when it creeps in as it has with Amy and certainly onto the campuses and it's affecting learning and debate, I mean, it's very depressing.
Yeah. I wholeheartedly agree.
All right, Natasha, well, I'm glad you were able to sit in on that. And thanks for everything. And we'll see everybody next time. Thanks for listening. The Femsplainers is a weekly podcast carried on the Podcast One Network. Nat Frum produces and edits our audio and video. You can follow us on Twitter and FB at Femsplainers and on Instagram at Femsplainers Podcast. We love hearing from you. You can reach out to us via email at contact@femsplainers.com. You'll find all our episodes and more information about me and the podcast at femsplainers.com. And remember, we rely on your donations to keep this podcast going.
So please consider supporting us at patreon.com/femsplainers.